Hello, listeners. Welcome to Film Club, episode 23. Can you believe what? I'm 23 already. It doesn't feel like it, but it is, obviously. This week, we are discussing my latest pick, Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. But before we get into that, we should introduce ourselves, which is usually how it works. doing things a little bit backwards this week. I'm Mal Foster, of course, and joined, as always, is my wonderful partner and co-operator of this here filmatic vehicle, Mr. Daniel Seraph. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, thank you. It's been a while since we did this, so we should probably apologise. In fact, I should probably apologise. This is totally my fault. So, sorry, it's been a bit of a while having this come to you.
Oh, no. Well, you know, don't put the blame solely on yourself. I appreciate you trying to take the bullet there, but, you know, it takes two to tango and two to make a cinematic podcast. So, you know, we have been away for a little bit, but, you know, hopefully this will fulfill your retrospective cinematic needs. And if it doesn't, you know, sorry. I guess.
That's all we can do. We can just apologise. Yeah, hopefully it'll be worth it, though, because it is a really good film, so...
Well, I think so. This is like I said, it's my pick. It is Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket from the year 1987, based on the Vietnam War. As always, as we say at the start of each show, if you haven't yet seen the film, you're going to want to pause this because it will be spoilers aplenty, and it will be pretty pointless to listen to this if you've not seen the film, because there's be a lot of stuff that you don't understand. So if you haven't seen it, pause this, go watch it, and then come back. And then, of course, leave your correspondence and let us know what you thought of the film as well. So what did you think of it? You've seen this before, I'm guessing.
Yes, I have. I've seen it once before. And I do really, really like it. I don't think it's probably as good as a lot of people think it is. I don't think it's close to being one of Stanley Kubrick's best films. I don't think, I guess, in the war genre, it's probably not one of my favourite war films. But there are a lot of really interesting stuff. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in Full Metal Jacket I think is definitely worth talking about. And I think what I really like about the film is that, you know, the first time I watched it, I kind of saw it as simply this kind of anti-war movie, this kind of anti-war political statement. But it's actually a lot more than that as well. And there are a lot more layers to it than simply just that, especially in the first half of the film, which I think is just absolutely amazing.
The first half is... just, it's gripping and it's weird. It's one of those sort of experiences where you don't realise the first half is over because it goes really quickly in the sense that you are totally taken away from whatever else surrounds you. You're just kind of engrossed and sort of gripped by what's going on because it's very intense right off the bat when you've got, what's his face? The drill instructor dude, Ernie...
Sergeant
Gunnery Hartman.
His name is Hartman. Yeah.
Yeah. When you've got him, he's straight off the bat. He's the opening note. It's the country song with the head shaving, which slightly hypnotic and bizarre, but you know.
But also a perfect way to open the film, which I think we'll probably go into.
No. Jump into that. How do you see that as a perfect way to open?
Well, I mean, what I noticed this time around, like I said before, one of the things I guess I didn't see the first time around was that the entire first half of the film is basically... I mean, it looked to me as if it was just kind of Stanley Kubrick showing how this kind of military marine training camp is just completely dehumanizing these people and like taking away from them everything that makes them who they are. And so that kind of opening scene seemed kind of symbolic to me, you know, like you just kind of shave them of their hair. And then, you know, slowly over the rest of that opening half of the film, you know, they're kind of taken of their names and of their personality and of their beliefs. And then, you know, we get into that second half of the film where they're just kind of rebuilt as these complete, like, weapons of, like, they're just weapons. I mean, they're just robots with guns, basically, by the time they get to the second part of the film. So I think there's like, I think the opening scene is the shaving of the head, then you get to the second scene where, you know, they're then taken of their names, you know, they're given these names like Snowball and Cowboy and Pyle and Joker instead of, you know, their real human being, like Christian names. And then, you know, as you go through that kind of opening act, you have that great scene where, you know, the gunnery, whatever his name was, Hartman, asks Joker, do you believe in the Virgin Mary? And he says, like, sir, no, sir. And then they get into this argument about it, and he, like, slaps Joker, and, you know, they're just, like, totally taken away of everything that makes them human and just turned into just these robots basically.
It's weird because you kind of have this mirror image. You kind of have this idea that you have these young men who still are at the time men, about to be transformed into machines, and they're facing their mirror image, their future. You know, if they survive the boot camp and they go through the war and they survive it, then they'll be turned into these really hard-boiled non-human entities. Because essentially, Hartman is not a human because of just how intolerant and horrible and disgusting he is. I mean, there's a point where I think just to sort of tying off that thing where he says about the Virgin Mary, and he says something about, he doesn't respect his disbelief, but he respects his honor. And he says something really weird and throw out, like, "I like you, you can come round and fuck my sister." And it's like, who says that kind of thing? You know what I mean? It's weird. It's like they're actually just staring in front of what they could become. And I think that is almost is very cerebral beginning to a film to begin with. But just the sheer dressing down of them, it's horrible. It's horrible to watch another human being just sort of tear away the top layers of someone like that so callously.
Yeah, it is very harrowing, and it's even more harrowing when you get to the very few moments within that opening act when they actually show some kind of humanity. I think it takes about half an hour into the film when Pyle turns around to Joker and says something like, "Everybody hates me," and it's like the first time you actually get some genuine human emotion in the film, as opposed to people just marching to the same beat and singing the same songs and wearing the same things and doing the same activities over and over again, like these rituals. Like, you get someone that actually like kind of breaks out of that and actually shows some humanity. And then, like, of course, the second time you get that is the climax to the opening act, in which we're then transported into the second one when Pyle shoots himself in the head. And again, it's a very different expression of humanity, but it's just this kind of thing where he's just like, "I'm not opting into this." Like, that's how it seemed to me. That it's just like, I don't want to be a part of this like crazy system where you're all just like completely like have no freedom of thought or emotion or anything. Like, it seems like this kind of symbolic gesture to just shoot himself in the face and have it done with, and just like opt out of that. And so it's very powerful when you get these two moments when, like, within this kind of 45 minutes in which, not many people have any kind of genuine relationships or emotions, they actually show some individual thought.
Yeah, it's interesting because anybody who knows about Kubrick and Kubrickian, is if that's even a word,
Yeah, I think that's what
Kubrickian.
people say.
Kubrickian, okay, fair enough.
Kubrickian? I don't know.
Kubrickian filmmaking is that everything he does allegedly was deliberate, and you kind of get the sense that the pairing of Pyle and Joker is definitely a deliberate combination because, as you say, you have just this totally dehumanizing opening first half, and you get these two glimmers, real small glimmers of humanity, where it kind of just pulls you out of the machine for a second, and it's kind of really sort of insidious and almost devilish of Kubrick because it gives you a sense of hope when you watch. If you've seen the film before, obviously you know what's going to happen, but as you're watching for the first time, you kind of get the sense that, oh, hang on, he's Pyle's going through a rough time, but here he has kind of like a sense of camaraderie with Joker. Perhaps something might actually develop from here, and he might actually find a way through. Obviously, the way through is through his skull with a gun in the bathroom later on. But it's almost kind of really tenaciously cruel of Kubrick to actually do that, to kind of go, well, it might get better, and then it doesn't. And it's wonderful because it is just deliberate, and it's so fitting to the tone, and it's so well executed. But it's kind of grim and bleak at the same time.
But I don't mind that because, I mean, like I said, I mean, this is definitely an anti-war film. Well, at least I think it is. I don't know if
Oh,
you agree with that.
absolutely, yes.
It definitely is. But like, one of the things that I've like, a lot of people think that, for example, like Saving Private Ryan is one of the best war films ever made, and I totally disagree with that because it's an anti, like an anti-war film. Yeah, sure, but it's also like, it also kind of romanticizes it a little bit, and there's like glory and nobility and this kind of brotherhood between them. And even though it definitely has moments of the film where it's very harrowing and brutal, there is this kind of heart to it, which I think is a little bit not, which is maybe a little bit pro-war. Whereas with this film, you don't get any of that. Stanley Kubrick has no qualms about showing you these flickers of hope and brotherhood and glory and stuff, and then just stripping it away within a moment. And I like that about the film. I think it suits the purpose that it's trying to serve. I think, really well.
Yeah, it's very deliberate and it's very political in every aspect of the film, because I do see it very much as an anti-war film, and I think it's hard not to, because of the especially the first half, where you see the dehumanization of people and you see what that environment can do to people, but also when you see them actually in the war as well. You know, there's a scene where you kind of it again showing an almost devilish glimmer of sort of camaraderie, where they're all kind of hanging out together at one point, and then it kind of culminates in them arguing who's going to have sex with a prostitute first. And it's that kind of horrible, debased aspect which kind of rips any kind of empathy for the characters out of the screen. And again, just very deliberate, but very purposefully done, and very sort of incredible in its execution. And it's just a little thing, but again, very sort of political, and it's a very prickly subject as well, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not just I don't just think it's a story that's also very deliberately done. I think, even if you look at all of Stanley Kubrick's films, he's stylishly very deliberate and very precise in what he does as well. And I think that shows in Full Metal Jacket as much as any film that he does. I mean, he's like, to me, I think he's probably one of the best people at like framing things that there has ever been in cinema. And it's like not just in the first half when you get, these great shots like through the kind of I mean, I don't really know what it is, the long rooms full of beds and tables, and it's all in kind of deep focus, and you just see these lines of Marines like all just in the same position, holding the same gun in the same way and doing exactly the same kind of thing and with the same mannerisms. You also get it in like the second half, and it's a great scene where they're kind of all approaching this building where there's a bunch of Vietnamese hanging out in, and it's just kind of like this kind of synchronized thing where a good person will walk in front of the camera and then go off camera and another person will come in, and it's all very it's so well photographed and so well choreographed, I guess, as well by Stanley Kubrick. He's like, I mean, like you say, he's a very deliberate director in the way that he captures everything and executes everything. And even though I think there are probably some faults with the second half of the film, I think it kind of loses its power in the second half. Like, I don't think you can fault the way that he captures it, which is just so well executed.
It's interesting you mention that, because as much as I do love this film, I do think it kind of loses a little bit of its momentum in the second half. And I mean, it's not surprising, because you know it's a difficult watch to begin with because of the intensity of the film. But to kind of match and maintain the intensity that the first half projects is pretty impossible, because you have that breaking point where obviously Pyle kills himself, and then it has to go on from somewhere else, because otherwise it would just be repeating itself. But I think because it's set itself up and it's kind of really tightened the wires of tension for so long in the first half, it does slacken, and it does kind of lose a little bit of momentum in the second half. What kind of like what issues in the second half of the film do you find yourself having?
I mean, that was pretty much my issue. Like, I think the first 45, 50 minutes of the film are so good because it's so kind of claustrophobic in a sense. You just get this kind of like spiral of long takes and all set in this kind of very kind of claustrophobic environment of this kind of training camp, this boot camp. And then suddenly within a shot, we're thrown into this very weird kind of landscape of Vietnam. And, there's this I guess a kind of fractured story in which, there are lots of different things happening, the characters taken through various places and with various, other people to interact with. And it gets it I guess, I mean, you said slackens, and it really is, I guess, the best way to describe it. It does kind of lose that tightness and that grip that it had in the first half. But I mean, I don't know if that's something that was maybe intentional by Stanley Kubrick in a way, in that it's just kind of you kind of see these kids kind of taken into this boot camp and then thrown into this kind of confusing, like just weird landscape where they're all just so like confused about what they're doing there and unsure about what their role is and if they're helping the Vietnamese or killing the Vietnamese. I don't know if maybe this is something that was actually intentional by him, and given Stanley Kubrick's history, I wouldn't be surprised if it was intentional by him. But I do think it kind of slackens a little bit in terms of its grip.
I would say it's intentional, because I mean, you look at the direction that it goes, it kind of goes from being a localized film to a global film, because it shows them kind of in the the factory process line, essentially, to begin with, and then they're kind of shipped off as products, as you said, as weapons. And it's kind of, it looks, and this is where it kind of takes on a different take, but it's also interesting, and again, very political. In fact, you could argue that the second half is somewhat even more political than the first, because it kind of does question if they are helping, if they are actually doing any justice, any service to the people there, because it kind of takes a little look at the sort of civilians and the residents of the area, and sometimes it shows them in bad light, sometimes it shows them in a sort of innocent bathed light as well. It's an interesting contrast, but it kind of opens up perhaps the political aspects of the film, and also just the general scope of it. It becomes larger, and I think because of that, you don't have as much tension, and as like I said, it kind of slacks. But I mean, it's interesting that it takes a different direction, and it works, but it doesn't quite work as well, perhaps.
No, yeah, I mean, it absolutely works. And, what he does in that second half of the film is very, very good and very interesting. I think the kind of thing that, I guess the one symbol that kind of strikes me from that kind of second half of the film is Joker's helmet, which has got on it written Born to Kill, with then the peace sign attached to his jacket, which kind of, it really kind of sums up the kind of moral ambiguity of the whole situation that these soldiers find themselves in which they're kind of trained to kill. But then, over the course of the second half of the film, you see them sort of question why they're there. There's a great scene when they recreate some interviews with these soldiers, and they kind of ask this question about, why are you here? What do you what are you achieving here? And they can't really answer it in a sense. I mean, they come up with answers, but they're not very convincing, compelling answers. One of them, quotes the president. Another one kind of says that he's just like, oh, yeah, it's just my place to be here. They can't really come up with a real definite good reason for why they're there. And so it's, there's a lot of interesting stuff in that second half. I think it's maybe the fact that the first is so good that's really the problem. Because it is just this. I think like that opening 50 minutes is some of the best stuff that he's done. And the second half, because it is such a dramatic juxtaposition, it doesn't, it obviously doesn't fit in and purposely doesn't fit in with the first half. It just feels like a bit of a step down. But what he does, I mean, is still very fascinating and very interesting. And, it does stand alone very well.
I'm glad you brought up the scene with the interviews, because I think that's definitely a key point in the film. Because you've come to this point where they've been through the training, they've basically been stripped down, they've been turned into the machines, they've been shipped off to do the job, and essentially all they know is that they have a job to do, and they don't really know why it is they're there to do it. Some of them think they know, some of them just flat out don't, some of them just at that point don't care anymore. And I think you get such an interesting view. It's presented almost like a news report, like you would watch on TV in like the 70s during that time, like it was something that you could imagine being screened on like the news. And it kind of almost kind of comes directly into your home, into your viewing space, that you're getting all of these answers, but they all kind of seem not so much predetermined, but all kind of almost instilled in them, like it's not an original thought, like all of these ideas have been so ingrained in them that it just comes out naturally, and it's almost like you are now finally seeing the end product of what this whole war and this whole system has made.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's probably the first time some of them have thought about it. I mean, one of the most haunting scenes from the film for me is when Sergeant Hartman, whatever his name is, kind of makes these soldiers recite, kill, 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 like as their duty. And that's basically just what they're there to do. And I think, for the first time in the second half of the film, you see many of these characters kind of thinking, well, what for? Like they've just been trained to be like, well, as I said before, just they don't have independent thought. They don't, have independent emotions. And then for the first time, they're sort of forced to have this in kind of reflecting it, like about what they're doing and what their purpose is there. And I think it is definitely, at least in the second half of the film, a real standout scene, the interviews.
To be honest, I do love the film, and I'm glad I picked it, and I'm glad I got to watch it again, because it has been a while. I'm hoping that you've enjoyed it as well.
Oh, absolutely. One more thing though, I want to ask you, because it's one of the few things that's kind of stuck in my mind about the film. I can't really find an answer to, is one scene. I know it's one that people debate as well, so I think it's probably worth bringing up.
Okay.
It's in the first half of the film when Sergeant Hartman is speaking to the Marines about their duty and about what they learn in the Marine Corps and what their role is, and he references both Lee Harvey Oswald
Yes.
and Charles Whitman,
Yes.
and sort of, I mean, kind of holds them up as kind of figures of what they should aspire to be. You know, these are great shooters. You know, these are people who were trained and disciplined in the Marines, and it's such a weird scene for me. Like, it, you know, it seems like, I mean, it comes into the film, and then, you know, it's not really built upon that scene. And I was just wondering what you kind of took away from it, or what you thought, you know, its purpose was in the film.
I think that's a really interesting. So if I remember rightly, when he's telling, because he's asking these questions, and it is about Lee Harvey Oswald and what's it?
Charles Whitman, I
Yes,
think, yeah.
and there's a weird sense because the camera, if I remember rightly, zooms in closer and closer towards Pyle, and that is when you kind of see almost like a crack in him. That it's almost like that is the moment of truth for him. It's like his breaking point, because from then on he's really good at putting his gun together and he's really good at shooting. And it's weird. It is like a real sort of dividing point in the film. But it is a weird scene, and it kind of almost comes across as like Hartman saying these psychopaths, essentially, these people who are known for committing atrocities that have kind of shocked the respective areas are kind of like the high standards for which you should be achieving. You're almost looking at them as role models, and you kind of look, especially within the case of the dude who shot Kennedy. I've just said his name now. Lee
Lee
Harvey.
Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, there's a dude who killed one of America's most beloved presidents, one of America's most progressive political figures, and yet he's kind of been held as like a role model for Marines at that
Yeah,
moment.
if I remember, he says something like, you know, where did, like, how far do you think this guy shot John F. Kennedy from? And people are saying, you know, from the book depository. And he says, like, you know, 250, you know, meters away. And he's kind of held up to be like, this is what you should, like, be. This is what you can learn in the Marine Corps, how to shoot like Lee Harvey Oswald. And it's just such a disturbing moment where it's like, wait, what? Okay. And I mean, I guess there's like, I think there's probably like a couple of ways to read it. It's interesting you mentioned about the kind of breaking point for Pyle. I don't know if it was maybe like a foreshadowing, or if it was some kind of political statement, or if it was maybe just like there to show the psychological trauma of what you go through in these training camps and boot camp and as a Marine in war. I don't know.
I think it's definitely a political statement, because you kind of look at it at the sense that the Marines are, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm sure Hartman says it's something about God's invention but America's blessing or something to that degree. Basically, they serve as a tool of justice for America. Yet here is this guy that's been put on a pedestal as, you know, this is the upper echelon of skilled marksmanship. He was a Marine and he killed like one of America's most prestigious historic figures, which is a very anti-American, very anti-nationalist thing to do, you know, and yet you as a weapon of America are expected to reach that level, and it's kind of almost cannibalizing itself and contradicting itself, and I think that is a very, I think that's one of the most blunt political statements in the whole film, is that the whole thing is just redundant and it kind of swallows its own tail. To a degree, but I think that scene's really kind of, I'm really pleased you brought that up because I forgot about that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of the most interesting scenes in the film, in that, you know, you do keep coming back to it and thinking, what was the meaning behind all that? But I think, yeah, I think you gave a very good argument for that.
That's my interpretation anyway. I mean, the thing is, with a film like this, a film of any handling with Kubrick, is there's so much that is up for interpretation. I think it's evident that he is very much an and or was rather very much an anti-war person, and this film, to a large extent, it's not completely an anti-war film because there are other points and layers to it, but it's very much his stamp on saying war is kind of a redundant waste of life on both sides, and I mean that's definitely one of the more blunt points to his statement.
Very well said.
Yeah, so there you go, Full Metal Jacket. Hopefully you've enjoyed it at home. If you've seen it for the first time, it'd be interesting to gauge your reactions, especially if you yourself actually like war-based cinema, how it stacks up against other films you may have seen in general and within its own genre. So yeah, even if you've seen it for numerous times and you've picked out some stuff that perhaps we've missed, we'd love to hear from you regardless if it's your first or your gazillionth time watching it. Even if gazillion is a number, I don't know. But so that was my last pick, which means that this week it is time for public pick, which means it is time to shuffle the random plastic box and pull out a random film. The only one that I can remember, actually, there's two that I remember being in there. One is Kids, which
Oh,
Gwen Reyes recommended not so long ago. Gwen Reyes, of course, our podcasting co-partner on the podcast, which you should also listen to if you like this and other kind of movie stuff. So, and the other one is the one that I think you're dreading, Silence of the Lambs,
Yeah, I've been dreading that film.
which I think would be pretty apt because I kind of want to watch the Hannibal TV show. I believe it's got Mads Mikkelsen in it.
Yeah, the fantastic, brilliant Mads Mikkelsen. So, if it came out today, I'd be quite happy to sit through it again as kind of a precursor to watching the Hannibal TV show.
Other than that, I can't actually remember what else is in there.
Do we have Blowout in there, I think?
Quite possibly.
I think we have Blowout in there. I'm not sure what else. Jaws, I think, is still in there.
Yes, Jaws, which I will not argue against because I do love a bit of Jaws. In
I
fact,
would be. I'd certainly be more happy with Jaws coming out than Silence of the Lambs.
I've been trying to get my mother to watch Jaws, but she refuses. And I'm like, you watched The Raid with me last year, so if you can. I say she watched. She kind of watched from behind, like closed fingers over the eyes. I was like, if you
I think
can,
that's how everybody watched The Raid
yeah.
last year.
I was like, if you can watch that, you can watch Jaws. But she refuses. So if that comes out, maybe I'll force her to watch it and get some additional notes that way. But whatever it's going to be, I'm pretty sure it's going to be a pretty good watch. Let's give it a rumble, and we'll see what falls out. Okay. I always like this bit because it adds a little bit of extra tension. Because you never know what you're going to get. Like a box of chocolates, if you believe Forrest Gump, which I recently rewatched and liked a lot.
It's awful. That's something that we should never put into film club. I hate that film.
Why? Why do you hate Forrest Gump?
We let's save this for let's throw it into the public pick at some point,
Oh,
and
okay.
you can find out why I hate this film.
Okay. Oh, you are kidding me.
What is it?
Oh, it's only Funny Games, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Which one? The original American remake?
I don't know. That is a
Or is it
good
not
point.
specified?
It's not specified.
So what should we go with? Let's go with the original. It seems only fair, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, they're pretty much symmetrical in everything but casting, essentially.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll go with OG Funny Games.
As a little bit of context, Mal, you hate Michael Haneke. That was the reason for the deflated reaction there.
Yeah, I hate most of his films that I've seen that I've actually made myself watch. Yeah, I should put as a precursor that Funny Games is actually one of my most hated films of all time.
Let's put it this way. I'm a big Michael Haneke fan, and I mean a huge Michael Haneke fan. I don't like Funny Games at all. I think it's definitely one of. It's the film that really proves everything that all the critics of Michael Haneke say right, if that made any sense. Everything that everybody hates about Michael Haneke kind of shows in this
Oh
film.
yeah, it comes to light in a huge way.
That said, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the film that's definitely worth debating, so I think it's a good choice.
Actually, yeah, as much as I remember hating the film, and I have, bear in mind, I've seen the original and I've seen the remake only once a piece. So it'd be interesting, if nothing else, to go back and revisit it and see how it holds up. It'd be a tough watch, I'm not gonna lie.
It's basically, for those of you that haven't seen it, Michael Haneke's attempt to kind of provide some kind of criticism on cinematic violence. And it's this kind of home invasion story about these two guys who break into a family's home and for 90 minutes put them through excruciating torture. All the while kind of including the viewer in the events of the film in several ways by kind of breaking the fourth wall to actually speak to you as an audience member. And I suppose kind of make you feel guilty for watching violent films, which would make sense if the film itself wasn't violent, but it kind of is. So it kind of contradicts itself in a way. But that's something that I'm sure we'll get to next week.
It is. So we're agreeing original 97, original Hanukkah version. Funny games. There you go. That is your next pick. If you've never seen it, it'll be an interesting watch, and I'll be interested to see what people's reactions are for the first time viewing it. I also actually be interested to see what people like myself going back to it for the first time in a couple of years actually think of the film as well. It's definitely gonna polarize people and split opinions, as does the man in general himself. But it would be interesting nonetheless to see how Funny Games turns out. Oh, it could be breaking the waves all over again. Who knows?
I don't think anything will be breaking the waves all over again.
And I think that kind of set its own precedent.
Yep.
So there you go, Funny Games, 1997, Michael Haneke. I will put, as usual, a link to. I will put the actual trailer in the show notes at screeninvasion.com as well, where you can get in touch with us about Full Metal Jacket or any of the other films that we've talked about, as well as heading over to Facebook, looking out for the Screen Invasion page on Facebook, and there you can find the Film Club forums where you can come and talk to us about any of the films, including Full Metal Jacket and Funny Games, at length. In your own time, and do so, because it'd be interesting to get your take on especially Funny Games. I'd like to see some opinions and comments on that. And who knows? Who knows? Maybe this might be a case of second time as a charm. It has happened before. It happened already once this year with Les Miserables. Maybe Funny Games is my new Les Mis. I wouldn't put the bank mortgage on it, but you never know. I might like it
Who
somewhat.
knows? Who knows?
Exactly. So until next week and episode 24, go watch Funny Games, enjoy, or at least
In a sense.
experience, yes, and we'll speak to you in 2 weeks' time. We'll be back in 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, I think so.
2 weeks. There you go. 2 weeks to get your Funny Games on. So other than that, ta-ra. Which
Bye.
is a rather English way to say goodbye.
That's a very, very English way to say goodbye.
Yes, ta-ra. Thank you.